procedures like reconstructive surgery. It has not always been so. 100 years ago, progressivism was associated not with animal rights, but with an attack on individual human rights in the interest of social efficiency. The racist sociologist and social efficiency advocate Edward Ross, whom we encountered in the preface, was not alone. In his book, Illiberal Reformers, the economist Thomas C. Leonard has documented how some figures once revered as paragons of modernity, from Woodrow Wilson to Virginia Woolf and D.H. Lawrence, endorsed forced sterilization and even mass euthanasia of defectives in the interest of prosperity and healthy future generations. So did a number of heroes of the left, like the radical economist Scott Nearing. His more conservative Yale counterpart, Irving Fisher, who made and lost a fortune as an inventor of filing card systems, even regarded eugenics as the basis of a future religion. In the post-war years, revelations of the horrors of National Socialist killings of mental patients, as well as those of the Holocaust, discredited at least older movements for what was once openly called racial hygiene, especially once American influence on Nazi eugenics became notorious. The decades from 1945 to the 1970s were also the peak of physician-centered medicine, as antibiotics appeared to promise a germ-free future, and the Salk polio vaccine removed the most dreaded viral threat. A generation of young doctors were taught to be scientist clinicians. A growing proportion of the middle class, including many unionized workers, was covered by health insurance. The conquest of cancer seemed within reach when President Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act in 1971. The popular metaphor of a war on cancer, like the war on drugs, implied that, as in the Second World War, the stakes were so high that a quick and successful conclusion outweighed economical use of resources. Medicine in general was becoming increasingly costly, even allowing for inflation, but its inefficiency was implicitly thought inevitable, just as the expense and delay of litigation seemed the price of giving all parties every opportunity to make their case. In 1952, an attorney in the Federal Civil Service and a popular legal writer, William Siegel, even provoked academic wrath with his book, Law, The Science of Inefficiency. Only arbitrary and dictatorial bodies, like the Tudor monarch's infamous Court of the Star Chamber, Siegel argued, have avoided the inefficient tangles of the common law. The West reached a turning point in the 1980s, as voters endorsed the cost-cutting brand of efficiency that Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and other politicians praised as free market, under fire from progressives then and now. The U.S. private insurance industry promoted health maintenance organizations that limited choice to participating doctors and hospitals agreeing to negotiated rates. Prescription costs could be controlled by restricting reimbursement according to schedules of preferred drugs and favoring generic medications. The burden of additional paperwork encouraged the consolidation of group practices. What has happened since the 1980s falls into five categories. 1. The rise of the electronic medical record with detailed standardized procedure codes as a key to efficient medicine at the cost of some efficiency. 2. The exploitation of the evidence-based medicine movement by pharmaceutical manufacturers who can shape statistics to control evidence. 3. The promise of precision, personalized medicine based on sequencing individual genomes, which potentially can save lives but also introduces new sources of inefficiency. 4. The rise of the quantified self and health monitoring devices, which in turn help make enhanced communication with healthcare providers possible, but may also complicate patient-provider relations. 5. The proliferation of false positives, overdiagnoses, and alarms, the result of more sophisticated tests and medical hardware, leading to caregiver fatigue, unnecessary patient stress, and sometimes adverse outcomes. None of these technological trends is intrinsically harmful. In net results, we are better off with current technology than we would have been by avoiding it. On the other hand, the nature of medicine, like that of education, makes it impossible to measure everything of value. An examination for a scientific or engineering degree can determine whether or not a candidate has mastered essential knowledge and formulas. Employers' initial satisfaction with the preparation of new professional staff, salary records, and the like are also eminently quantifiable. Much more elusive are the qualities that make people efficient later in their careers, especially when efficiency means resolving unexpected, messy problems that don't generally appear on examinations. The point is not to disparage quantification, but to understand its biases and limits. In principle, electronic medical records have been the obvious answer to one of medicine's most glaring and sometimes fatal inefficiencies, the notoriously illegible handwriting of many physicians, and the challenge of communication among primary care doctors, specialists, nurses, and pharmacists. Well into the 20th century, library schools taught a standardized hand for writing catalog entries on index cards. But while librarians have always strived for uniformity and legibility, physicians until recently had a professional tradition of autonomous practice that has impeded sharing. The consequences of such inefficiency have been tragic. In 1999, a U.S. Institute of Medicine report estimated that 7,000 patients in the United States died annually as a result of errors in reading prescriptions. It estimated the cost of all prescription errors at $77 billion annually. In one British survey published in 2002, fully 15% of medical records examined were found to be illegible. Beginning in the early 2000s, new electronic prescription systems began to replace paper documents. While an improvement, they were no panacea. According to another report of the Institute of Medicine published in 2007, issues of usability, readability, training, and suboptimal system safeguards continued to result in errors. One study found 22 distinct kinds of mistakes resulting from electronic systems. Such reservations are not arguments against new technology or for the restoration of paper. They are reminders of what we have seen about educational technology. Efficiency is difficult to implement efficiently. It takes more time, money, and failures than advocates expect. And electronic prescribing is only the beginning of a much more complex set of challenges, the electronic medical record, an idea that sounds clear enough, but introduces a new real world of complications. We can start with data entry. The electronic record is not just a word processing style document with some embedded test results and images, but a standardized unit of an increasingly national system. To make medicine more efficient for the government agencies and private insurers who manage payments, conditions and procedures must be standardized. Rationalized medicine is managed with tables of detailed codes. These are not entirely computer-age innovations. Those who have seen Billy Wilder's masterpiece, Double Indemnity, will recall Edward G. Robinson as the Pacific All-Risk Crack Claims Investigator, Barton Keyes, challenging his boss's attempt to portray the victim's death as a suicide, rattling off all the subcategories of suicide in his actuarial tables, and pointing out that there were no cases of jumping from moving trains. In fact, statistical standardization of medicine was already almost 90 years old in 1944 when the film appeared. The government of France's Emperor Napoleon III had introduced the first such list in 1855. After repeated delays, American physicians and hospitals finally accepted the latest version of the codebook, the ICD, International Classification of Diseases, 10, in October 2015. Medical managers have welcomed the change. On the positive side, the additional training needed to learn the system is just part of the inefficiency needed to become more efficient. If all physicians could simply get on with diagnosing and treating patients and leave the administrative details to office and hospital staff, including America's 168,000 professional medical coders in 2014, there would be little controversial about the change. Some of the categories inspired mirthful newspaper reporting and even Twitter feeds. There is not only a code for bird bites, but individual codes for species. For example, an initial medical encounter after a macaw bite. We might wonder whether ICD-11 will further subdivide macaws into blue and gold, spixes, and so forth, or consolidate the citizen categories. There is another for an orca attack. A few are so bizarre and even apparently physically impossible, such as burns from a flaming water ski, that they might have been pranks by fatigued code experts, or perhaps dummy entries to detect copyright infringement, just as dictionary and map publishers have been known to insert bogus words and places, respectively. In fairness to the World Health Organization, which establishes the master list, many of the categories singled out by sarcastic journalists were added by U.S. health officials, and use of the more arcane subcategories is optional. Whatever their potential long-term benefits for the quality of care, electronic medical records, EMRs, have not made physicians more efficient in the sense that most laypeople and business managers use the term. They have not reduced administrative overhead or freed time to see patients. While there seem to be no evaluations of practice before and after EMR's implementation, they seem to have accomplished the reverse. One study of interns at the Johns Hopkins University Medical School in 2013 discovered that they were devoting only 12% of their time to patients and over 40% to computer work. Another paper, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in September 2016, confirmed this impression among practicing doctors. With EMRs, it revealed, physicians spend far more time on administrative tasks than most patients realize. For every hour of direct contact, doctors spend 2 hours at the office filling out EMR forms and completing other paperwork. Those who kept home diaries reported 1 to 2 hours each day of additional work at home. These findings were not surprising. They confirmed a number of recent letters to medical journals and the lay press about grunt work and supported studies of the increasing rate of medical burnout. Some senior medical administrators agree with this impression. Robert W. Brenner, the chief physician of a hospital network using EMRs, told a conference that, "I've seen physicians at their wits' end, absolutely panic-stricken about how they're going to see patients and do what they have to do." Emergency room physicians may need to perform 4,000 mouse clicks during a 10-hour shift, according to one study, or an average of one every 10 seconds. Potential abuses compound the problem. A minority of doctors do abuse incentives. For example, in some plans that pay physicians according to the degree of risk rather than by the procedure, there is a serious incidence of upcoding, exaggerating the risk of cases for higher reimbursement. Safeguards against such practices only add to the complexity of claims and reviews. Of course, there are positive effects of electronic record keeping too. It can build checklists into medical practice, alerting doctors to recommendations and possible side effects, and if used wisely, it can monitor quality of care, even as it also risks diminishing that quality. Since ICD-11 was still under development when this book went to press, it is difficult to say whether it will be a net gain or loss for the efficiency and the effectiveness of medicine. The increasing power of information technology in analyzing medical data and diffusing the results to professionals began in the 1990s as a means to control spending on unnecessary medications. The prospective double-blind study, in which neither investigators nor patients are aware of which doses contain the active ingredient and which are placebos, seemed to guarantee rigorous evaluation. The out-of-pocket cost of the series of animal and human tests needed to achieve approval by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, not to mention other national and transnational authorities, has been estimated at $1.4 billion by the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development, an amount to which the center adds $1.2 billion in losses of other uses of that money, plus additional research after the drug has been approved. Critics of the pharmaceutical industry consider these costs inflated, but however they are defined, there seems little doubt that despite improvements in the efficiency of research tools since 2003, expenses have increased by 145%. Drug regulation is inefficient even compared to other regulatory processes, and deliberately so. The chances are much higher that a new chemical will be ineffective or even harmful than that it will be a milestone in healing. So procedures have been correspondingly cautious since the early 1960s, when lax policies on pre-approval testing of the sedative thalidomide resulted in an epidemic of birth defects. Since 1962, pharmaceutical manufacturers have had to demonstrate not only the safety but the effectiveness of new drugs, with some later exceptions for the experimental treatment of terminally ill patients. While the FDA's official historical pamphlet notes the increased efficiency of electronic transmission of research data since 2000, the process still has a high price in time and money. And the development of new drugs demands especially qualified and highly paid scientists, making expenses so far impossible to reduce. As equipment becomes more sophisticated and generates more data, the results take increasing skill to analyze. Efficient instruments create a demand for elite analysts. We already heard in Chapter 3 that advanced online courses and individualized learning are costly to deliver for similar reasons. The economist William Baumol identified this paradox in the arts and education as well as medicine. It is commonly called Baumol's cost disease, although Baumol pointed out that the growth of overall wealth will make spending increasing proportions of GDP on health less painful than we imagine. In the 1990s, a breakthrough in pharmacology seemed on the horizon. Rational drug design, using knowledge of the basic mechanism of molecular biology to create molecules targeted for specific diseases, with fewer side effects and more rapid development and testing. The movement is still alive and may yet achieve its promise, but so far, like the majority of potential efficiency breakthroughs in all fields of technology, rational drug design faces unexpected obstacles of nature, complexity that sometimes can be discovered only in trying to implement a new principle. The chemist and Scientific American blogger Ashutosh Joglekar has penetratingly summarized its problems. Nature, rather than corporate greed or the patent system, makes innovation hard. It can take extensive work to determine which proteins are responsible for disease, and even once that is known, the structure of some proteins makes it difficult to design molecules that can click into place and bond to them. Even if these succeed, other proteins, especially those responsible for the spread of cancer, may adapt to take their place, just as bacteria evolve under the selective pressure of antibiotics. Once a target protein has been identified, millions of natural and synthetic molecules may be tried to determine which is a hit, one that still can only potentially be modified to become an effective therapy. Finally, our body's cells have evolved to keep foreign substances out, and their structure will repel both water and fat-soluble molecules, so that a delicate balance must be achieved. Half of all new drugs are still derived from naturally occurring substances that have been collected painstakingly and screened. As Joklicker acknowledges, even rational drug design still has a large element of serendipity because of all the obstacles nature has put in our way. Biomedical researchers and pharmaceutical companies have thus been in a challenging position. It is increasingly easy to acquire and analyze mountains of data and to test unprecedented numbers of possible molecules for their match with proteins that cause disease. Someday, new artificial techniques may or may not create a far more efficient way to design drugs. Meanwhile, publication and testing have concentrated on the improvement of known families of molecules and their extension to other conditions. Sildenafil citrate, trademarked by Pfizer as Viagra, originally was approved as a heart medication, then became a blockbuster after its role in treating erectile dysfunction was discovered and marketed brilliantly, and then was prescribed as heart medication for a condition affecting mainly women. In fact, according to one recent study, a quarter of all transformative drugs introduced since 1984, defined as both innovative and having a major impact on patient care, have been repurposed, often from government and philanthropically funded research on rare diseases. While the efficiency of data analysis may eventually lead to new transformative treatments, evidence so far has been discouraging. After all the information technology breakthroughs of the 1990s, only 4 of the 26 transformative drugs, about 15%, were approved after 2000. So far, data analysis has been used, according to critics of biomedical research, to exaggerate the value of small changes benefiting mainly marketing and patent protection. In fact, skeptics say information technology can make biomedical science much less efficient by padding the literature with questionable results. How efficient is today's biomedical research? Thanks in part to technological changes that have shifted scientific publication to digital formats, in which the marginal cost of distributing additional copies approaches zero, scientific journals and papers have been burgeoning. From 1996 to 2011 alone, 25 million papers were published by 15 million scientists around the world. Yet academics who have studied the quality of results have reached alarming conclusions. 85% of those papers, they believe, are worthless. Many influential results have failed to be replicated. This is not due to the structural inefficiency we noted before, a consequence of the obstacles that reality puts in researchers' way. In fact, critics would be happy if more negative findings were published. The real problem is that papers make exaggerated claims for the validity of their results. Authorities encouraged the healthcare efficiency movement of the 1990s, evidence-based medicine, EBM, as a reaction to the exaggerated claims of pharmaceutical salespeople. Hard data, it was hoped, would curb waste. The replication crisis is the unintended result of this crackdown. It is possible, without breaking any conventional ethical rule, to design medical experiments and analyze their results to maximize the appearance of effectiveness, even when a careful examination of the data reveals faults, like a small sample size or statistical measures of significance that are not as meaningful as they usually seem. As we have seen earlier, the late 20th and early 21st century faith in metrics can distort the quality of what is being measured. Remember the rise of the quantitative study of the researcher's productivity and influence in Chapter 2, and especially the rise of citation analysis. From the very beginning of the movement, the professionals who developed it were careful to point out its limits, just as pharmaceutical companies disclose side effects in their package inserts and in those disconcerting, rapidly recited lists at the close of their television commercials, oral fine print. To the pharmaceutical industry's critics within the medical profession, the EBM movement has been hijacked by a proliferation of questionable studies. One important check on the limits of papers has been systematic reviews and meta-analyses, which study data and conclusions from multiple papers to achieve stronger validity. But the epidemiologist John Ioannidis, who first called broad attention to problems of replicating scientific findings in 2005, has discovered that in practice, reviews and meta-analyses have compounded the problem. Since these genres are cited more often than the majority of papers themselves, they have become a favorite means of professional advancement, especially in China. Instead of promoting evidence-based medicine and healthcare, Ioannidis summarized in his policy points, these instruments, systematic reviews and meta-analyses, often serve mostly as easily produced publishable units or marketing tools. Even when industry has the best intentions, the number of publications may help neutralize them. As the study of transformative drugs has shown, pharmaceutical makers rely heavily on academic rather than internal research. And the explosion of papers by researchers seeking tenure and promotion means that there may be thousands related to a single disease, where an industry research manager may have to follow a half dozen diseases. Conventional reporting about science takes the sheer number of papers to be a measure of the product of knowledge. But since many authors are under pressure for quantity as well as quality, numbers can also signify a strategy that journal editors call salami slicing, the division of results that could appear in a single paper into multiple ones. Editors consider this strategy marginally ethical, and some discourage it by requiring authors to disclose other papers in press or submitted. But salami slicing is also institutionalized and rationalized in academic science. An anonymous dean, writing in The Chronicle of Higher Education, has even suggested that the least publishable unit, as slices are called, has the virtue of building a young faculty member's self-confidence and writing skills. Less positively, the writer acknowledged that many of his fellow administrators are incorrigible bean counters who will never be persuaded to pay more attention to quality than to quantity. Their policy may be less effective, but it is more efficient in the use of their own time. This efficiency unfortunately makes the larger academic and publication system less efficient by promoting information overload, and burdens academic libraries with spiraling costs for journals, disproportionate to the growth of significant results. A cure for the cycle of journal price increases and subscription cancellations seemed to appear with the rise of open access, generally online-only journals, available without charge on the web. Authors, or more usually their institutions, pay charges upfront to support peer review, editing, and website costs, a far more efficient way to launch a new journal than to pay heavy upfront costs and hope for enough paying subscribers. In fact, such publications may be too efficient. With minimal barriers to access and pressure from a growing number of scientists around the world to publish, the number of open access journals has exploded. According to the Open Access Directory Project, there were 9,156 peer-reviewed titles in October 2016, and over 2.32 million articles. Of these journals, as many as 10% could be fraudulent, according to a librarian and researcher, Jeffrey Beal, who posted a list of over 300 suspect publishers on the web. Other whistleblowers wrote nonsense articles that were accepted and were able to join editorial boards with dubious aliases and made-up credentials. Yet despite these scandals, it has proved impossible to draw a bright line between legitimate and exploitive journals, just as it is not always easy to distinguish real from fake news. There is a gray area of opportunism and relaxed standards that falls short of fraud. Some open access advocates insist that only about 1% of journals are founded in bad faith. Confronted with challenges to his methods and threats of litigation, Beale retracted his list in January 2017. In a European biochemistry journal later that year, he explained that he had withdrawn the list specifically to end an aggressive campaign directed at his superiors at the University of Colorado. An anonymous and highly personal anti-Bell site has nonetheless remained, claiming to represent a group of librarians around the world united for open access against the alleged predatory blogger. In 2017, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, applied for a preliminary injunction against one of the most prominent open access journals concerns, the Bangalore India Omics International, accusing it of misleading researchers into spending $26.6 million or more on publication and conference registration fees. Omics has countered that the charges are fake news, inspired by Bell's discontinued blog, defended its reviewing procedures, and blamed the legal action on FTC bias toward traditional subscription-based publishing. Whatever the merits of the case, a Bloomberg Businessweek report revealed that Omics's contributors and conference participants did not all fit the stereotype of struggling researchers in marginal institutions. They included some of the largest U.S. pharmaceutical companies, which the article alleges use open access to avoid the rigorous review standards of leading conventional journals in promoting new products. Some companies did not comment, while others considered Omics's open access journals appropriate for at least some kinds of studies. The efficiency of publishing and of measuring the quantity and quality of researchers' output in biomedical sciences would be no problem if demand for and supply of researchers were in balance. But it is not. Even in the relatively fortunate U.S., over 85% of new biomedical PhDs will not find tenure-track academic positions. As Gina Colata wrote in the New York Times about prolonged postdoctoral fellowships at 1990s pay scales that can last until researchers' 40s, biomedical scientists in academia are essentially apprentices until middle age. Given the obstacles to streamlining medical practice without burdening and demoralizing physicians, and the use of information technology to accelerate pharmaceutical breakthroughs, at least one other path to medical efficiency appears to be open: personalized medicine based on sequencing of individual patients' genomes. The statistical studies in clinical trials draw on relatively small samples of patients. Some important side effects are not discovered until after a drug is widely used. This is not the fault of information technology. To the contrary, the most efficient way to reduce risks is to use massive databases of prescriptions and results, especially since neither animal nor clinical studies can deal with the range of possible interactions among drugs. Russ Altman, a professor of bioengineering, has pointed out that the average 70-year-old takes no fewer than 7 prescription medications. Their necessity and their contribution to longevity and well-being are another issue. Altman's graduate student, Nicholas Tatonetti, found a way to look beyond the FDA's adverse event reporting system to a more precise analysis. Tatonetti and Altman were able to isolate populations within the database that were similar in variables like age and gender, but differed in whether a single drug like one for hypertension, was prescribed. Those not receiving the drug were a natural control group. If adverse events like headaches or vomiting occurred more often in those taking the drug, there was a good chance that it was responsible. Patients could also be sorted according to pairs of drugs. The results showed that there were many more side effects than package inserts had disclosed, an average of 329 versus the average of 68 acknowledged by drug manufacturers. And there were over 1,300 adverse effects from combinations of two drugs in a database of 1,332 that could not be attributed to a single one of the pair. Algorithms can thus help make medicine more efficient by identifying drugs that should be used with greater caution or even be removed from the marketplace, saving money as well as lives. But this form of efficiency has a limit. It can interpret only after the fact, not predict results. And sometimes drugs must continue to be used despite known serious side effects. Thus, from the 1990s, the project for the sequencing of the human genome has been linked to the exciting prospect of a new model of medicine, in which the genetic markers for susceptibility to disease and to adverse effects in treatment can be established by sequencing the genome of every patient and tailoring therapy to his or her unique DNA. Precision medicine, also known as personalized medicine, is a 20th century development of an ancient idea that each person has a distinctive constitution and needs customized remedies to bring his or her body into balance. This was the basis of the four humors theory of Galenic medicine and of India's Ayurvedic medicine, as well as of the 19th century homeopathic movement. Homeopathy has survived partly because of this personalization, despite its contradiction of chemical laws that declare its medicines to be inert. In the rapid expansion of the pharmaceutical industry after the Second World War, physicians and scientists began to study why some patients had adverse reactions while others did not. The geneticist Arnold Mattelsky was the first to identify hereditary susceptibility to side effects of individual medications in 1957, inaugurating what became known as pharmacogenetics. By the late 1990s, genetic information could be used to tailor treatment for some forms of breast cancer. When the human genome was first sequenced in 2003, it appeared that a new age of medicine would begin. By 2007, genetic testing became routine in decisions on prescribing the anticoagulant warfarin. In 2009, a new test allowed hospitals to examine patients' genes for mutations affecting drugs' effectiveness. And by 2014, the cost of sequencing an individual genome had declined to only $1,000. By 2016, major programs in the United Kingdom, the 100,000 Genomes Project focusing on rare diseases, the United States, the Precision Medicine Initiative involving 1 million volunteers, and China were set to compile large data sets. In principle, projecting further declines in the cost of sequencing and tests, precision medicine promises to be a breakthrough in efficiency as well as effectiveness. Yet, precision medicine is still necessarily inefficient in the sense that most fundamental work is inefficient. It takes more time and effort than investigators realize when they start a project. Social psychologists usually see this as a regrettable negative tendency, the source of delays and cost overruns, and their negative name for it is the planning fallacy. Only after the genome was sequenced was the full complexity of gene expression realized. It became clear by about 2010 that the prospect, promoted by science writers, if not by all the leading genomic scientists, was not succeeding. The science writer Stephen S. Hall, in a review in Scientific American in 2010, summed up the skepticism at a low point of the movement. The central problem was that the relatively easy scenario for genomic medicine, the search for common genetic variants, finding the DNA variants that tended to distinguish people with a disease from those unaffected by it, was a failure. Hall quoted one of the pioneers of genomics, Walter Bodner, as acknowledging that the vast majority of those variants have shed no light on the biology of diseases. The skeptics of precision medicine are no more able to prove their case in advance than advocates are. It is true that multiple genes control human development and health in combination, and also that gene expression is affected by environmental factors like hunger and stress, which in a few cases appear to have hereditary consequences. Even identical twins do not share these epigenetic influences exactly. Recent studies have suggested the role of the bacteria and other microbes in the human gut and small intestine in affecting a number of illnesses. And though the ratio of microbes to human cells in the body is now closer to 1.3 to 1 than 10 to 1, the composition and balance of the human microbiome is still a powerful, though largely unexplored, influence. It appears, for example, that breasts and possibly other organs have distinctive microbiomes that may affect the incidence of cancer. Precise therapy might have to rely on both genomic and microbial analyses, and could thus be exponentially more complex. One prominent skeptic of precision medicine, the hematologist-oncologist Vinay Prasad, has written extensively on medical reversals, abandonment of well-established treatments, diet recommendations, and pharmaceuticals that turn out to be ineffective or harmful. Prasad has observed that in his own specialty, precision medicine successes in producing remission have been limited to a small number of super responders, and that the one controlled study of precision oncology showed an almost equally discouraging rate of progression-free survival in those receiving therapies based on their individual mutations, as opposed to the control group treated according to their own physician's judgment. 2.3 months versus 2.0 months for the control group. While recommending continued trials, he has called the movement inspirational rather than promising. And some internal medicine specialists, all too familiar with substance abuse, poor dietary choices, and other lifestyle issues, believe that environmental factors swamp the benefits that precision medicine might give to many of their patients. Some statisticians have also discovered previously hidden flaws in big data analysis, especially in medicine. Notably, Xiaoli Meng in lectures at the Royal Statistical Society in London and at the University of Chicago. While Meng's analysis is technical, he summarized the problem of big data in general in an email. Once we take into account data quality, a seemingly tiny defect would take an enormous sample size to compensate. The point is that big data can be valuable, but only with more skill and sophistication than many commentators assume. Genomic optimists have a strong case of their own, expressed by another oncologist and best-selling writer, Siddhartha Mukherjee, who has warned against obsession with negative, unintended consequences of innovation. His arguments recall Albert O. Hirschman's hiding hand concept, which we have already encountered. Once we commit ourselves to a goal, we may discover surprising resources to reach it. Mukherjee has observed in The Gene that nature often turns out to be unexpectedly simple rather than monumentally complex. In the early 1950s, each organism was thought to have such a distinctive, dauntingly complex genetic code that there could never be a theory for all life. The discovery of the double helix proved that nature was surprisingly simple, with a single molecule and a single code for all life, enabling modification of the genomes of all organisms, and even, by 1980, making possible the production of mammalian proteins in bacterial cells and vice versa. The existence of master regulatory genes supports the hope of finding more simplicity behind the complexity of DNA. To extend Mukherjee's analysis, the genomic revolution did for biology what the scientific revolution of the 17th century had done for cosmology. Just as the stars and planets were known to be made of the same matter as Earth, though this could not be truly confirmed before spectroscopy and space probes, rather than special substances, so a gene is a gene, whether in a potato or a person. Behind the multiplicity of genomes are master regulatory genes that can determine the complex facts of anatomy and physiology. One of the most promising areas for precision medicine is not genes themselves, but another component of DNA, the switches that turn them on and off, and that are sometimes located on the genome far from the genes they control. A number of these switches may influence diseases like schizophrenia, multiple sclerosis, and diabetes, according to research by the molecular biologist and Broad Institute director Eric Lander and hundreds of colleagues in a federally funded program. Personalized medicine may yet become as revolutionary as antibiotics. Lander has observed that 60 years elapsed from the birth of the germ theory of medicine to the production of penicillin, and he has said that his position, even at the height of enthusiasm in 2000, was that the project would really be for our children's children. Even if we accept the skeptic's view of the odds against the prospect, it appears to be an excellent risk, even if, after a generation, the goals and techniques of precision medicine turn out to be significantly different from those of today. It accounts for less than 1% of the $34 billion budget of the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH, in fiscal year 2017. It is very possible that our grandchildren will have, as a result of the successes and failures of genomics, a very different idea of the gene itself than that of the 1990s, just as 1990s ideas were radically different from those of the early 1950s. As Lander himself noted at a summit on gene editing, while there are 4,000 to 5,000 genes affecting disease, they mainly affect probabilities, work in combination, and may also have positive roles, which could be why evolution has spared them. That is an argument against permanent germline genetic engineering, though, rather than individual gene therapy or tailoring treatments to individual genomes. The point in the context of efficiency, though, is that, like other groundbreaking work, it will be, as Lander's timescale suggests, inefficient, needing many false starts to find more productive concepts. What can we do while we're waiting for bespoke treatments? There are other ways to promote health by knowing ourselves, according to technology enthusiasts. One might be called genomics light, genotyping for known genes rather than compiling a complete sequence of an individual's DNA. Even after the rapid drop in the price of sequencing, the latter is still a questionable expense given the lack of insurance reimbursement and of FDA-approved treatments that require knowing a full genome. Genotyping is limited to genes already known to affect health, disease, or even quirks like the ability to detect certain tastes. This procedure is now easy enough that the best-known genotyping company, 23andme.com, offers the service for only $199 and has 1 million customers, according to its fact sheet. While the health information in 23andMe's reports was originally limited to risks of hereditary transmission of disease, in April 2017, the FDA authorized the company to sell tests that directly evaluated an individual's genetic risks. The private company's market capitalization exceeded $1 billion in 2016, and probably increased after the ruling. Yet despite this commercial and regulatory success, There are grounds to doubt whether people will actually use genetic information to change their lifestyle and reduce their risks. Until genotyping is more widely accepted, the most popular form of medical self-knowledge is likely to be self-monitoring through wearable technology. According to the information technology website Engadget.com, nearly 20 million devices like wristbands and smartwatches capable of recording motion and monitoring at least some vital signs were sold in the first quarter of 2016, an increase of more than two-thirds over the same period in 2015. The information technology consulting firm IDC estimates that the global market for wearables, including wristbands, watches, clothing, eyeglasses, helmets, and other accessories, will reach 216.3 million units by 2020. An April 2016 report by the consulting giant PwC shows how popular the concept has become. In 2014, over 20% of PwC's survey sample owned at least one wearable. By 2016, the proportion stood at 49%. 36% owned more than one. Health was the most important reason for purchase. The number of respondents declaring themselves excited by wearables had grown from 41% in 2014 to fully 57%. The report also notes, though, the continuing skepticism of non-wearers, suggesting to me that technological attitudes may become increasingly polarized, as political identities have. Wearables promise healthier living then, and possibly insurance savings, to many or most of their users. Self-monitoring appears to be a logical development in the movement for more efficient living. But there is more than one side to efficiency. The same technology that empowers people through self-surveillance and voluntary sharing of personal data with friends and family members has another potential. Monitoring by employers and possibly even by governments. For many information technology enthusiasts, this may be not a bug but a feature, an opening for a benevolent paternalism that can combat deadly trends toward obesity and sedentary living, reduce healthcare costs, and increase longevity. Other studies cited by PwC estimate that there were already 75 million wearables in the workplace by 2016, and that by 2020, fully 8 million people would be required to wear them as a condition of employment. About half of respondents saw efficiency as the prime benefit of wearables. And far from resisting Big Brother, participants also expected his helping hand. Two-thirds thought that employers should pay for, or at least subsidize, monitoring devices. 37% thought their companies should adopt cutting-edge technology, even if it did not improve productivity. There was even greater enthusiasm about wearables in the home. Parents were 50% more likely than non-parents to own a mobile device. And they saw benefits ranging from health, 85%, through productivity and parenting in the 70s, to relationships and stress levels in the 60s. If the report is representative, self-monitoring is on the way to becoming a domestic right. Whether it can add 10 years to users' lives, as 70% of respondents now believe, remains to be seen. One surprise of the PwC report is that privacy is not only declining as a concern, despite the increasing possibilities for networking, surveillance, and hacking, but ranks low in reasons for non-adoption. Still, there are signs of resentment that concern some advocates. When companies promote fitness contests, monitoring steps and other physical activity, some employees unscrupulously attach their devices to hamster wheels, power drills, and even family dogs, a recurring problem of measurement as an incentive. Perhaps inspired by such evasion, researchers at MIT, as though to confirm long-standing leftist suspicions that the entire institution is a corporate conspiracy, have developed badges that monitor employees' social interactions as well as vital signs. The idea behind the project is not panoptic or Orwellian scrutiny, according to the founder's description. Supervisors do not have access to the data of individual staff members, though the latter can view their own information. Rather, the aggregated data provide insights into what distinguishes strong from weak performers. Members of lower-scoring groups, for example, communicate with each other less often. Earlier versions of the badges have also revealed how financial traders, who have yet to be replaced by algorithms, respond to losses and other stress physiologically. The software might help at least some traders retain their balance. The profits of the vendor, a Boston-based company called Humanize, come not from sales of hardware and software, but from use of the data. Stripping data of links to individuals does not guarantee privacy. Security specialists have shown that it is often possible to re-identify people who have been de-identified for their protection. It is not certain, though, that employers or others would have either the motivation or the means for unauthorized snooping apart from any legal consequences. The more serious problem of employer-sponsored and self-directed activity monitoring alike is different. It is that the efficiency of gathering data about people's activities in the short term does not make the technology necessarily an efficient or effective means to fitness in the long run. The unintended consequences of self-monitoring technology were revealed in a study by a professor of marketing, Jordan Etkin. Etkin performed a series of 6 experiments with undergraduate and adult subjects, web-based, using Amazon's Mechanical Turk program for payment, engaging in a variety of activities, not only walking, using a pedometer rather than a more advanced device, but coloring shapes and reading texts. The performance of some of the participants was measured and reported to them. Control groups had no such feedback. Etkin's findings were consistent with years of social psychology research on intrinsic and extrinsic rewards, a line of research challenging B.F. Skinner's idea, which we encountered in Chapter 3, that all behavior can be positively shaped by carefully administered rewards. Later psychologists have discovered that when people receive external rewards for something that gives them pleasure, they enjoy it less. In fact, the educational critic Alfie Kohn has even argued, in his book Punished by Rewards, that positive reinforcement can be as harmful as the old punitive ideas that Skinner thought society should overcome. Writing more than a decade before the rise of wearable computing, he saw all forms of incentives as conservative techniques for social control. Those whose steps were tracked by the pedometers lost interest in walking and walked less, in fact, less than control group members whose activity was never measured. Measurement, Etkin found, even reduced participants' overall sense of happiness and well-being. While there are enthusiastic wearables users who scoff at such findings, other anecdotal evidence confirms them. 2 writers have shed light on the problem. Carrie Rahm, in her New York Magazine blog, even describes the existential angst of stopping measurement of her steps by Fitbit. Paul Ford, in The New Republic, relates how he developed a program in pre-wearables days to track food and exercise to reduce his obesity. He ended his self-devised and temporarily successful program, regaining his weight, unable to bear the self-monitoring regime. Weight loss, the self-improvement industry in general, he wrote in his diary, is a kind of natural physical postmodernism. You become the text you are editing, rewrite your feelings, the body. He saw his friends' Fitbits and other wearables as unsustainable. Rahm's and Ford's experiences, and those of others, show how self-monitoring can begin as an exciting and rewarding project and become an onerous duty. Depending on the activity, it can take weeks for pleasure to return. It is possible that this is a minority response, despite Etkin's findings. After all, as we have heard, many experiments in medical and behavioral sciences cannot be replicated. On the other side, a number of other social psychologists have reported similar findings, and numerous other papers report the disadvantages of extrinsic motivation. Is it possible that people using activity trackers under medical supervision with goals of weight loss will benefit, even if